You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'm Salman Rushdie, and I was supposed to introduce this, but actually I don't think it's necessary to say very much in the way of an introduction, because I think the things you will hear and see tonight really speak for themselves. But I'm going to just take a minute on behalf of Penn to thank the Cooper Union and our co-sponsors for this event, the Burma Project of the Open Society Institute and the New York Review of Books, for making this evening possible. I'd like to welcome our special guests this evening, among them some of our courageous Burmese colleagues, and also several members of the International Burmese Monks Organization, to whom all the proceeds from this evening are being donated in support of their cyclone relief programs. And again, it's great that you all came to support and to contribute to this essential work. I'm also going to say a little bit about this evening and about Penn's work in general. As you know, the bedrock of Penn is its international campaigns on behalf of writers who are in prison or under threat because of their work. And for the past two decades at least, as we will be reminded throughout this evening, there are few countries that have been tougher on writers than Burma. Today, actually, we received some wonderful news. A few of you may have seen. The Burmese regime has today released several political prisoners, among them U Win Tin, one of the remarkable writers we're going to be featuring this evening. And by the way, it just means that you're going to be, when you leave, you're going to be offered letters that you might like to sign and send to the Burmese ambassador. Now, on one side, you'll see it's stamped released, because that means that's actually about U Win Tin, who has been released today, which is great. But the letter on the other side is for a writer who's still in danger and in under arrest, so it'd be great if you could collect these form letters and sign them. It's certainly no coincidence, I think, that the releases today, this morning, come on the anniversary of last year's brutal crackdown on peaceful demonstration. And it shows that this regime, like many tyrannous regimes, is sensitive to the kind of attention it will be receiving this evening. We celebrate these releases, but we should note that not all the news is good news. Last week, 10 people were sentenced to jail terms ranging from 2.5 to 9 years in prison for taking part in last year's public protests. And last month, two members of the National League for Democracy were jailed for 2.5 years each for presenting a letter to the government asking for action against rising prices. So our efforts on behalf of our colleagues in Burma, one of the grim constants of Penn's work over the past two decades, must continue. What has changed in recent years as we work to expand the right to write in other countries is our sense here at Penn American Center that we are on much shakier ground ourselves with respect to basic human rights and free expression principles. Now an event like this can also be a disturbing mirror. Tonight we will hear accounts of government neglect and incompetence in the response to Cyclone Nargis, of the suppression of information and official propaganda, of hooded prisoners and torture and abusive detentions. It is a deeply disturbing sign of the times that so many of these passages hit so close to home. I want to assure you that the irony is not lost on us and that Penn is working every bit as hard to address these threats to freedom of expression here as we are to support our colleagues around the world. And I really hope, if you aren't already, thank you. If you're not already a member, I hope that you will help that cause by becoming a member or an associate member of Penn and join the effort. Join these efforts. So, thanks again for coming and enjoy the evening.
Thank you, Salman. I'm Maureen Ong Thuyn of the Burma Project of the Open Society Institute. Thank you also, Penn, New York Review of Books and Cooper Union for making this event possible. Particularly, I would like to thank our readers and all of you in the audience for demonstrating your solidarity with the courageous monks and nuns and the voiceless citizens of Burma. In the decade and a half that our foundation has been supporting the Burmese democracy movement, we have come to know the military regime in Burma as a very tough opponent. The laws against freedom of expression are draconian. You can get up to 15 years for possessing an unregistered modem, for example. Frankly, I don't know why they bother with laws, because they don't need any reasons to put anyone away without cause, without a charge, and of course without a trial. Information technology made it possible for thousands of citizen journalists in Burma to send images of what was happening in their country during the monks' protests last September, and also during the devastating cyclone Nargis that followed 8 months later. But the generals are also getting more sophisticated. Just this week, major exile news outlets, the Irrawaddy, the Democratic Voice of Burma Radio, and the New Era Journal, came under massive cyber attacks. Large files of many gigabytes were sent to websites that have been exposing the atrocities committed by the military. These huge files came from multiple sources from around the globe, indicating a coordinated attack. Evidently, cyber attackers can be hired for $500 to $600 an hour, which is more than most Burmese earn in a year. There are many people from many places in the audience tonight, and soon news and videos of what we say here will be available to people in Burma and around the world. I would like to therefore appeal to everyone who knows how to send an email, and that includes my 88-year-old mother, to send, and often, the biggest gigabyte file you can find to www.myanmar.com. That's the regime's website. Spread the word. Although the monks and nuns of Burma continue to be hounded, jailed, and derobed at will, they were the first, and in many places, the only responders for over 2 million victims of the devastating cyclone Nargis. We are honored tonight to have with us so many venerable friends of the Buddhist Sangha, or the monkhood. Some of them have been jailed in Burma. Many had to flee after last September, and all here are now in exile. Several of the monks arrived in the United States less than 2 weeks ago. They have kindly agreed to bestow on all of us here a short blessing at the end of the program. So please stay in your seats until the Metta Sutta, the chant of loving kindness, has concluded. Finally tonight, we also honor the memory of Japanese photojournalist Kenji Nagai, who was shot and killed by a Burmese soldier while covering the protests. Thank you.
I'm Joseph Lelyveld, and if I may just toss in a personal aside, I want to say that this is a cause very dear to me, because I'm one of the very few non-official Americans who can say that he's actually lived in Burma. I went there as a young student 46, 47 years ago, and I've seen what this regime has done to the friends I made there over all those years, and so this is very important work. Now, you're looking at some recent work by the Burmese government scrutiny board, one of the busiest and most relentless censorship boards in the world. The editors of a weekly magazine submitted their August 8th issue for review, as they must do with every issue, and they were told that they could not run six of the articles, I believe it was six out of nine. They couldn't run a review of a book of pictures, artistically rendered pictures of the effects of the cyclone. They couldn't run a piece about Indonesia's efforts to lift a European Union ban on Indonesian airlines. They couldn't run a story about an NGO working with people with HIV/AIDS, or a profile of Condoleezza Rice, or a story about how Singapore is a good place for exiles to live. On this page, the editors were allowed to keep stories about a man appealing his rape conviction in Indonesia and about J.K. Rowling as a top earner among world authors, and to run the photograph of Korean students participating in a water safety drill. The scrutiny board reviews all publications, newspapers, magazines, books, journals. Early this year, it reviewed an edition of the weekly magazine Love Journal and duly analyzed and approved a poem called February 14th, a seemingly innocent Valentine's Day lyric intended for lovers everywhere by the Burmese poet Saw Wei. This proved to be a mistake on the part of the censorship board. Let me explain one thing about the poem before I read a rough translation. It starts with a reference to an American poet of the first half of the 20th century named Walter Arensberg, whom I have to admit I had never heard of, and I suppose many people here have never heard of either. He's not to be confused with the Walter Arenberg, who was a Nixon ambassador and the owner of TV Guide and a great collector of Impressionist art. So Arensberg was very much taken with acrostics and anagrams, and he even studied the plays of Shakespeare to find anagrams that identified Francis Bacon as their true author. Somehow, Saw Wei, the poet in Rangoon, knew about this, and so his poem begins with a reference to Arensberg. That's why that aside. Arensberg said, "Only once you have experienced deep pain and madness, and like an adolescent thought the blurred photo of a model great art, can you call it heartbreak? Millions of people who know how to love, please clap your gilded hands and laugh out loud." Now, in the original, this is where Walter Arensberg comes in. The first letter of each line, read from top to bottom, declared, "General Tan Shui," that's the head of the regime, "is crazy with power." The magazine quickly sold out as word of the coded message spread. And on January 22nd of this year, Saw Wei was arrested for the poem. No information has been made public yet about what charges, if any, have been filed against him, and he's still held incommunicado. In 1991, Aung San Suu Kyi wrote this: "Within a system which denies the existence of basic human rights, fear tends to be the order of the day. Fear of imprisonment, fear of torture, fear of death, fear of losing friends, family, property, or means of livelihood, fear of poverty, fear of isolation, fear of failure. A most insidious form of fear is that which masquerades as common sense or even wisdom, condemning as foolish, reckless, insignificant, or futile the small daily acts of courage which help to preserve man's self-respect and inherent human dignity. It's not easy for a people conditioned by fear under the iron rule of the principle that might is right to free themselves from the enervating miasma of fear. Yet even under the most crushing state machinery, courage rises up again, for fear is not the natural state of civilized man." In early 2003, during one of the rare periods in the last three decades that she's not been under house arrest, Aung San Suu Kyi and other leaders of her National League for Democracy held several rallies outside of Rangoon. On May 30th, 2003, as she neared the city of Dibeyin, where she was to speak, a mob organized and orchestrated by the government attacked her motorcade, killing, the number is not very precise, but killing an estimated, or at least, 70 of her supporters. Aung San Suu Kyi barely escaped herself. Later, she was sentenced to another 5 years of house arrest. That 2003 attack is one of the many forbidden subjects in Burma, but in June, Cherry magazine published a poem by Chi Maung Tan called Dibirinja. Dibirinja is the ancient name of the city of Dibeyin. And the poem begins with a litany of famous native sons. Then it turns darker. In this town, Prince Padeng, who rebelled against King Mindun, once took shelter. And from here, the evil mayor, Ukan, fled to Lower Burma. And so in this town, heroes have been lost. In this town, traitors have grown wings. In this town, a young man lost his motorcycle. In this town, a lady's time to die did not arrive. In this town, things happen that make you clench your teeth. One day, in this arid place in winter, when you didn't even mention rain and there's no reason for clouds, suddenly it rained so hard even the elephant's tracks were washed away, wiped out. Traveling from Monywa to Yeou, when I look at this town from the car, ghosts from the past are haunting it still. Probably says something about their sense of history and literary skills that Burma's censors did not prevent this poem's publication. But once again, they made up for their mistake. On June 30th this year, Cherry's poetry editor was fired, and the Press Scrutiny Review Board ordered the June issue recalled from the newsstands. Unfortunately for them, it had already sold out. Around the same time, Aung San Suu Kyi's latest sentence expired, but in open defiance of the United Nations and the international community, the Burmese government has again extended her captivity arbitrarily. She remains under house arrest in Rangoon.
I am Paulo Pinheiro. From 2000 to May this year, I was the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Myanmar. During my tenure, I visited Burma 7 times. My most recent trip was in November of last year, when, sadly, my assignment was to investigate the very brutal abuse the junta committed while crushing the peaceful protests that spread throughout the country 1 year ago, exactly this month. Between September 26 and 29, 2007, the government used lethal force against monks who were peacefully protesting, a 500% increase in fuel price, and against the ordinary Burmese citizens who turned out to support them. Government forces killed and severely beat protesters and rounded up thousands, more than 6,000 in 1 week. I documented these abuses and the waves of abuse that followed. Torture, deaths in custody, disappearances, the denial of medical treatment to the wounded, and reprisals against the families of protesters. As in every one of my previous trips, I met some of the more than 2,000 political prisoners. I am very glad to know that the venerable Pinya Zota, who was in jail from 1991 to 1993 and from 1998 to 2004, and whom I met in 2002 in Tarawaji jail, is here. I think that he's there. You can't imagine how much I'm happy to see a prisoner that has left the prison. I'm here tonight because I want to introduce you to another one of those remarkable people. A poet and journalist, Woo Win Tin, who is 79, is the oldest and longest serving political prisoner in Myanmar. He has been in prison the last 19 of those years, since 1989. He was already a frail man when I first met him in 2001. In each of our 3 meetings since, he has been even frailer. Win Tin's home was a 6 by 3 feet cell in insane prison, the massive old warehouse of a prison the British built that now houses most of Myanmar's political prisoners. His cell opened onto a small courtyard where he spent much of his time, but there, as in his cell, he had no contact whatsoever with other prisoners. Win Tin's original sentence for working with the NLD had long since expired. He was now serving a 7-year sentence because he reported on prison conditions and human rights abuses to one of my predecessors. But as outrageous as his treatment had been, and as enormous as his suffering had been, Win Tin has never, never uttered a single word of complaint to me about his situation. He has an absolutely electric presence. When I met him last November, he welcomed me joyfully, as always. He was wearing a long blue shirt and Bermuda short because in insane it's terribly hot. He refused to discuss his health condition. But I know now that he had since undergone a hernia operation and currently is having difficulties eating and sleeping due to lung problems and severe asthma attacks. We spoke about many subjects, and then, as I always did when I visit him, I asked him if he would write down in my notebook one of his poems. Win Tin has been subjected to what I believe is the worst form of torture you can subject a poet to. For 19 years, he has been refused a pen or a pencil or paper, completely denied the means to write. And yet, he would write. He would scrape the red bricks on the wall of his cell, mix this red powder with water, dip splinters he pulled from wood in his cell in this paste, and write his verses on the floor. He then memorized the new verses and erased them. What you see behind me, yes, it is behind me, is the poem he wrote down for me last November. He had lost almost all the fine motor skills in his hands, and he wrote this with enormous difficulty. He wrote, "My time in prison, will death be my release? As long as democracy and human rights are not within reach, I decline my release and prepare to stay." Then, suddenly, an auspicious news this very morning. Win Tin, other 6 members of the NLD, 4 of them members of parliament elect from the 1990 elections, and another more than 8,000 common prisoners have been released. Win Tin left prison this morning absolutely unbowed, promising that, quote, "I will keep fighting until the emergence of democracy in my country," end quote. His Mandela-like presence, his cheerful, luminous presence and poetry will from now on shine outside the bars. Let's rejoice. But let's not credit the military regime that imprisoned him and his colleagues without cause. Thank you.
I'm George Packer, and this is Ugausita from the All Burma Monks Alliance, and this is U Shwezin U, who's going to interpret our very brief conversation. Ugausita was the young monk who was speaking into the megaphone in the first footage that showed the demonstrations. And I guess what I really want to ask you to begin with, Ugausita, is what made you pick up that megaphone? What gave you the courage to speak to that crowd?
Shin Tia, the Yuxia Mabia Warren Dime, I
took the microphone and stood in front of the crowds because people were getting poor, people were having many problems.
What kind of problems made you get up there and speak to that crowd? What exactly what are you talking about?
People were lining up at their passport office so they could work overseas and send money home. And children as young as 10, 12 were working at the tea shops. And housewives were facing a lot of problems with the inflation. And that's why we had to come and be with the crowd.
I think most Americans think of monks in Burma or anywhere as living a pretty separate life. Praying, chanting, begging for alms, but basically living apart and reading sacred texts. But you're talking about housewives and young boys having to work in tea houses. How do you know these things? What is the relationship between a monk and other Burmese people?
The American Masawino, Luria, Nale Mamuboli, through Nale, Pony Soyin.
ဒီကလူတွေနားလဲတာဘုန်းကြီးဆိုရင်ဘုန်းကြီးเจ้าမှာနေမယ်ဖះစာရွတ်မယ်ဟာလာလူတွေကိုဖះစာသိမိမယ်အဲ့လိုပဲနားလဲကြပါတယ်ဒါပေမဲ့အရှင်ဖះတို့ကြတော့ဒီလူတွေရဲ့ဒုက္ခကိုသိနေတယ်ဆိုတော့ဘယ်လိုလုပ်သိလဲဆိုတာကိုရှင်းပြပါဗျာဦးဇင်းတို့ဘုန်းကြီးတွေကပြည်သူတွေနဲ့တခါတကယ်မတွေနဲ့အနီးကပ်ဆုံးနေရပါတယ်တခါတကယ်မတွေရဲ့စင်းရဲကြက်တဲမှုကိုဦးဇင်းတို့ဘုန်းကြီးတွေက
Now, Uzino Sony Bari Kane Kama, Yenya, Tongwa Yayen, a good Takwa Yararu, Nakwa Yararu, a Lu Danari Ned Wandalu, Daria Nibidole Uzino Tinema.
We learn about these things from housewives who face these problems, and then the alms, when we go out to get alms, they have reduced from, let's say, from 3 to 1 due to the price.
3 to 1 what?
Cups of donations mm-hmm. of rice. So that's how we find out, and we see young children who are suffering.
In other words, you're not living apart from other Burmese. You know exactly what's happening in their lives.
Yes.
What? I have to say, I talked to a lot of monks in Burma on 2 trips this year, and they are the toughest people I met in that country. They, first of all, physically, they look like stevedores. Most of them have a shoulder bare, and they are in great shape. And mentally, they were the most... No need to translate this for him unless you want to. They... I don't know what kind of build is under that robe, but they were the most determined, practical, no-nonsense political thinkers I met. Compared to them, writers and artists had their heads in the clouds. So don't be fooled by the saffron robes. These are seasoned political organizers, as you could see from the footage of the September events. To save time, we can tell him all of that afterward and see if he agrees. I'm just curious, why did you become a monk? And how old were you when you did?
Now,
Why I became a monk is because I have respect for Buddhism, and
sasana, for
Buddhism, mm-hmm. sasana, and I became a monk at age 12.
And you ended up at the Megan Monastery, yes?
Yes, I'm from Megan Monastery.
Tell us a little about that monastery and why it was so important last September.
At
a monastery, usually there is always a gathering of people, you know, human rights activists and people from the opposition. We help HIV patients at our monastery. Since we got really involved in humanitarian work, the government was not very happy about it.
Why did the government have a problem with you doing humanitarian work? I mean, most of us think of that as being outside of politics. What was their problem? What were they afraid of?
They were afraid that we would be able to help them better, and that's why they were not happy.
I mean, as far as I could tell, in Burma, any organized activity, even a hiking club or a book group, was suspect, and you had to do it behind closed doors. So treating HIV patients in a monastery was surely a political act. Did the government interfere with the work you were trying to do for HIV patients?
We housed about 15 to 20 HIV patients, and the government would come and take them away, remove them from the monastery, saying that they would be given medication, but they were not really given medication.
Tell us what started the September events. What was it that put monks in the streets of Rangoon and other cities?
The All Burma Monks Alliance, we prepared for the September movement, and we've been planning this movement for a long time. When inflation hit really hard and the gas prices went up, people took to the streets and they started peaceful demonstrations, and that's how September started, the movement started.
And why were the monks the leaders of the movement?
We don't have any human rights in our country, and we do love freedom, and that's why to embrace freedom we started participating.
But in the past, in 1988, for example, it was students, it was workers, it was intellectuals, it was political leaders. This time it was monks. And what some monks have told me is it was because they knew better than anyone how much people had been suffering under this regime. both economically and politically. Is that was that why you joined that movement?
ရှင်ပြဒီရှစ်ဆက်ရှစ်ခုနှစ်တုန်းကဖြစ်ခဲ့တဲ့အချိန်တုန်းကဆိုရင်ဟလာစာရေးဆရာတွေဟိုတခြားလူတွေပေါ့လေပြည်သူတွေအလွှာလွှာတန်းစားမျိုးစုံကပြည်သူတွေပါခဲ့ပါတယ်ဒီတစ်ခေါက်ကြတော့စတေမာလာမှာဖြစ်ခဲ့ချိန်ကြတော့ဖုန်းတော်ကြီးတွေကထိတ်ဆုံးကပါတယ်ဆိုတာဦးဇင်းတို့နိုင်ငံမှာကလူအချင်းချင်းတအားနဲ့ဖိနှိပ်လာတဲ့အာဏာရှင်တွေကလုံးဝ
People are severely oppressed in our country, and that's why to relieve them from oppression, we started the chanting of the Metta Suttas, and that's how we got involved.
Did you think that the government would fall when you were in the streets last September?
Our
aim was not to bring the fall of the government, and our aim was to bring a dialogue.
Did you expect the government to talk?
I'd
like to stress that if international pressure does not continue, then they would just go on like this forever.
And when the soldiers who were in the streets in the footage we just saw began to fire tear gas and then live ammunition, not just at ordinary Burmese but at monks, did it surprise you?
The sitari ga jampen ni ne mye yi yo bong tong ne hla lu du o alu myo ne mye de so lu du o mye yi yo bong ne khwe pi yo We expected the crackdown, but we didn't expect them to be so cruel.
I mean, the soldiers are Buddhists, right?
Sitaria miado apie. Yes, they are Buddhists.
So how could they shoot at monks?
When I spoke to some of the soldiers, I believe that they were given medication, and that's why they were not able to think properly, and that's why they were acting the way they were acting.
And were you attacked? Were you injured during the demonstrations?
I was beaten on the Shwedagon.
At Shwedagon Pagoda?
Shwedagon Pagoda, yes.
How did you escape arrest?
Shinpia Pamakan Blu Lokevale.
Uzin Pamakanya, Uzin Nuye, Nanga, Mima Nanga, Ushido, Lebe, Uzin Lama, or Pascas Paya, Lobido, Shan Nanga, Ni Amu Mune, Zin Twakayavari.
I had to flee the country. In disguise as a bus conductor.
You took off your robe and put on a bus conductor's uniform.
Yes, so that the authorities would not recognize me, I had to disrobe and flee the country.
And now you're a long way from Burma. You're in Utica, New York, and some of your colleagues are back there. Are they able to do any organizing, is your movement still alive inside Burma?
ချင်းပြအခုဗမာပြည်ကနေဝေးရောက်နေပါပြီအခုယူတကာနယူးယောက်မှာရောက်နေတဲ့တွေ့အခုလောလောဆယ်အရှင်ဘုရားနဲ့သူလုပ်ခဲ့တဲ့ယဟန်တန်ဃာတော်တွေရောအခုလောလောဆယ်အတွင်းမှာဘာတွေလုပ်ခွင့်ရှိလဲလုပ်လို့ရောရပါလား
အခုလောလောဆယ်တော့တချို့တဝက်တွေတော့အခုချိန်ထိဆက်တွဲမရပါဘူးတချို့တဝက်ကြတော့ဦးဇင်းတို့နဲ့လုပ်ငန်းကိုဦးဇင်းတို့ပြန်ပြီးတော့ဒီမြန်မာနိုင်ငံလုံးဆိုင်ရာတန်ဃာတပ်ပေါင်းစုဆိုတဲ့အဖွဲ့နဲ့ဦးဇင်းတို့ထဲထဲမှာအများကြီးဒီကွန်ရက်တွေပြန်လုပ်နေပါ
Some of them, I'm not in touch with them at all, but some of them are still actively involved, and we have our networks, and the All Burma Monks Alliance is still active inside.
It's still active. So finally, Ugasita, what do Americans need to know, and what do they need to do in order to help you and the movement that you're here tonight to represent?
ရှင်ပြားအနေနဲ့ဒီအမေရိကန်ပြည်ကပိဋကတ်တွေကိုဘာပြောချင်လဲဘလို့သူတို့ဘလို့ကူညီပေးလို့ရမလဲဟလားရှင်ပြားတို့ဘလို့အထောက်ပံ့ပေးနိုင်လဲဆိုတာကိုဘာပြောချင်ပါလဲဗျာ
အဲဥစဉ်ကတော့ဥစဉ်တို့လူသားတွေမျိုးနွယ်တွေဆိုတာအားလုံးကအတူတူကြမှာအတူတူပါပဲအဲ့တော့တနိုင်ငံမှာဖြစ်နေတဲ့အဖြစ်အပျက်ကိုတနိုင်ငံကနေပြီးတော့လက်ပိုက်ပြီးတော့မကြည့်နေပါနဲ့သူတို့ခံစားနေရတယ်လို့ဥစဉ်တို့မြန်မာပြည်သူတွေခံစားနေရတယ်လို့ငါတို့လည်းခံစားနေရပါတယ်ဆိုတော့ဟာမျိုးကိုမြင်ပြီးတော့မိမိတို့ရဲ့တက်ဆိုင်တဲ့အစိုးရလေးနော် UN တို့ကိုဟိုအထူးသဖြင့် PR ပေးပြီးတော့မြန်မာအရေးကိုမြင်ကြပါဆိုတာမမိကြပါနဲ့လို့ဦးဇင်းတော်ဒီလိုပဲပြောချင်ပါတ
ယ် We hope you can help increase pressure on the international community and various governments and your own government so people can relate to the suffering of the Burmese people
Well I want to thank you for coming here tonight to enlighten us and for your courage in standing upto a brutal criminal regime back in your home of Burma. Thank you, Ugasita.
To be here tonight as the voice of the victims of Cyclone Nargis.
And I'm Orhan Pamuk. I'm going to read excerpts from the official press.
Orhan is the voice of evil. Okay. From a Radio Free Asia interview, I hope you can hear me. May 8, 2008. One of my sisters-in-law was hit by the waves and drowned. When I got there, Taga village, which has about 1,000 people, there were only 2 good houses left and they were no longer steady. The rest of the small houses have fallen and collapsed. Many cows and buffalo and people have died. I live in Hapyapon. At first, the water rose about 4 or 5 feet. The water came into the houses and the wind tore the roofs off. Ward 18 was entirely flattened. General Aikain is from Hapyapon. His father's house totally collapsed. General Mong Mong Ai is also from around here. His older brother drowned. People died horrifically. Their corpses floating in a row along the Hapyapon River. We can't find my sister-in-law's body. In villages on the ocean, when the weather's good, they're lively villages. One fishing company will have hundreds of workers cutting, cleaning, drying fish. Now it's as if these businesses have been pulled into the sea. The whole area where the river meets the ocean is submerged. In Gada village, where we lost my sister-in-law, it's like the surface of the ocean. The mouth of the river used to be 5 miles wide. Now it's about 100 miles wide. So far, there are no rescuers. They don't come here. In Hapyapon, the Union Solidarity and Development Association are all just idling. They're just faking it. People are relying on friends, acquaintances, relatives, and siblings who came when they heard the news. They're living on the boiled rice and dried noodles people brought and on food provided by the monasteries.
Now, this is the voice of the official press. This is from the New Light of Myanmar in English, May 29th, 2008. Every country has faced natural disasters such as earthquakes, storms, floods, volcanic eruptions, and tsunamis. In a natural disaster, the loss of human lives and property is based on the strength of the disaster. Our country suffered the cyclone Nargis recently. The people of Myanmar had never faced such a severe storm in their lives, so they did not think that the storm would be very destructive. Despite the public notices about the upcoming natural disaster, the people did not take it seriously. Now the storm and its aftershocks are receiving media coverage. Since May 3rd, the Prime Minister has been supervising the relief and rehabilitation tasks in the storm-hit areas, while ministers and deputy ministers are making field trips to the villages. In compliance with the instructions of the Prime Minister that, quote, every survival shall continue to survive, quote, emergency tasks were launched as soon as possible. My eyes were filled with tears when I watched on TV that the Prime Minister comforted the victims, gave away snacks and fed meals to the children in the relief camps. So it is fair to say that all the members of the National Preparedness Central Committee are now shouldering rehabilitation tasks with might and main. All in all, we have undertaken a historic national task successfully. However, I would say our country is going through a variety of storm plots and intrigues that are much more severe than Nargis, and they are endless. They are none other than envy storms, criticism storms, and rumor storms created by certain Western countries and national traitors at home and abroad who are showing a negative attitude to our nation and people.
From a Radio Free Asia interview, May 22nd, 2008. Many victims who came to Bogale seeking help were asked by the authorities to return to their villages because Senior General Tan Shui and other high officials were coming. We were told they were coming, and straight away an order came for those who were staying at the high school and monasteries to be put on army trucks and taken back to their villages. They were sent to the pier. They had with them rice and money, very little money, and what clothing they had. Nobody could remain behind. But about 30 people from Bogale who are close to the authorities were kept at the high school for display, and the school compound was cleaned. The main road from Bogale, where the officials were supposed to arrive, was also cleaned, and some rescue materials were placed there for display. People along the road were told not to leave their houses. All the roads in the area were closed. No trishaws, no bicycles, no motorcycles were allowed on them. They were closed for 2 days. Where we live, houses along the route received one package of food. They went around and placed these food packages in front of the houses. They said, "These packages are not for you guys. After the officials leave, everything will be collected back." And after the officials left, that's what they did.
Here is another spoonful from official media. From the New Light of Myanmar in English, May 29, 2008. In practice, every well-wisher may freely make donations. Local authorities do not impose any restrictions on any forms of donation at all. However, in some regions, people dropped snacks and things from moving vehicles, and as a result, a large number of people were waiting along the roads for supplies. Maybe some of them were storm victims, whereas some were opportunists. No one can know exactly where those waiting for vehicles along the roads are from and who they are. The people along the roads were in a scramble to get the things dropped from the vehicles. This can tarnish the image of the country and the people and downgrade the status of the victims. In addition, it can have adverse effects on the generosity of the donors. Indeed, the donors should have shown their respect in presenting their donations, while the victims should accept the donations in all modesty. Another point is that the victims gather into a large crowd and they might stop the vehicles by force for things, and they might not allow a car to move on if the passengers do not make any donations to them. If so, charity may grow into a robbery without violence. I would like donors to understand and accept that dropping things from moving vehicles to victims along the roads may harm the character of local victims. Some donors are making donations for political gains. In some cases, such people in disguise of donors incited riots by provoking the outrage of the crowd on the roads. Some shot the scenes in which people were in a scramble to get money and things dropped from moving vehicles and sold the tapes and photos to foreign media at the expense of the image of the nation and the people. If foreigners watching those tapes and looking at those photos misunderstand the status of our country, the image and dignity of the nation and the people will go down the drain. That is food for thought.
Radio Free Asia, again in May 2008. To reach Aceh Chongwa, we had to take a three-hour motorboat trip from Dedaye. No cars can reach there. We first heard about the situation there from a group of monks. They told us how bad it was, so I went with food. When I got there, I realized what they told me was really true. The houses were still in ruins, bridges were still broken. It looked like business was good at one time, there was a fishery. But no one can work now. Out of a population of over 1,000 people, about 600 remained. 300 or 400 died. It's been over a month now, but you could still see the bodies. According to the villagers, they couldn't tell who was who, so they gathered all the dead bodies they could and buried them near the cemetery. But they weren't able to carry some of those tangled in the groves and reeds. Some were just left at the edges of paddy fields. We weren't able to reach them since it was muddy there, but we could still see the bodies. The villagers told me that no one from the government has come yet. They haven't received any aid for food from the authorities, and no international groups have come yet either. Two or three groups of individual donors had come. The first was a group of monks who came to donate to the abbot. The abbot was there distributing things. Someone would get 2 peas of rice. Another person would get a certain amount of rice and oil. It was announced on a loudspeaker. Villagers gathered at the abbot's place with their bullock carts. They were living on these things.
Again, I'll be the pro-governmental voice, again from the New Light of Myanmar in English, May 20, this time 2008. During the storm Nargis, a large tree in front of my house was uprooted and the branches of many trees on Payanazu Hill were broken off. So from the balcony of my house, I have a wonderful view over the upper terrace of the glittering Shewedagon Pagoda. In the past, I could only see the rays from the spotlights over the pagoda. Now, I have a good view, so I'm somewhat grateful to the storm. However, about 20 days after the storm, the clear view turned dim, and I did not have a clear view over the pagoda. It was because the trees were in leaf again. The trees did not get any foreign assistance, nor did they see instant noodle packets. They were not provided with tents or purified water. Thanks to the showers after the storm and the fertile soil, the trees soon started to come into leaf. Human victims are not like trees in this regard. saw relief items, volunteers, and machinery from the four corners of the country, and relief fund and aid from global countries, organizations, individual donors, and from the people of Myanmar are flowing continuously into the country. The people living along the banks of Irrawaddy River may temporarily need instant noodle and biscuit packets. However, they can easily get fish for dishes just by fishing in the fields and ditches. In the early monsoon, large edible frogs are abundant. The people of Irrawaddy Division can survive with self-reliant efforts, even if they are not given chocolate bars from the international community.
From an interview in IRI in Iran, July 29, 2008. The night Nargis hit, I went into labor in a small bamboo thatched house on the banks of the Piapon River to deliver my first child. But as the wind roared, my husband and I struggled outside, only to see our home destroyed right before our very eyes. As the rain poured down and water began to reach my chest, my husband lifted me onto some floating debris. As I lay there, the labor pains became so painful, I began to scream. I needed help. Finally, among the broken pieces of wood, I gave birth, but almost died in the process. I had lost so much blood. Both my husband and the woman who had helped me deliver thought I was gone, but a single hope kept me hanging on, that my son needed me. After the cyclone, I thought the worst was over, but finally I understood that the worst of our hardship, bringing our lives back to where they were, had only just begun. Thank you.
I'm Siri Hustvedt. On June 4th, 2008, Burmese authorities arrested Meng Thura, better known by the stage name Zargana, which means tweezers, a nickname Thura received in the days when he was a dental student. Zargana is Burma's leading comedian and a strong opposition voice in the country. He is also among Burma's most fearless activists. When Cyclone Nargis hit, Zargana mobilized more than 400 entertainers to deliver aid. Their efforts, which they funded themselves, began only 5 days after the storm and reached people in 42 of Burma's most devastated villages, few of which had received anything close to sufficient aid from the government. As they worked to deliver supplies, Zargana gave several interviews about the work he was doing and the needs of the villagers. He also ridiculed the state media reports on the government's relief effort. I have no idea whether the people in the Delta are able to catch edible fish and frogs, he told one interviewer. Because of the water's color, we've renamed the Irrawaddy River the Bogale River. It has turned a chalky white we call the Nargis color. Dead bodies and the carcasses of cattle are floating downstream, and we call the stench the Nargis odor. When we return from the villages, the stink clings to us. Nobody can stand it. How could people find edible fish and frogs in an environment like that? During an August 14th hearing at the Rangoon West District Court, Zargana was charged with 7 offenses, including, quote, defiling a place of worship with intent to insult religion, end quote, and is now being held in insane prison. This is not Zargana's first prison experience. Since 1988, he has been incarcerated at least 3 times. Among his crimes, impersonating General Samong, the former head of state, an offense that brought with it 5 years in solitary confinement. He has been banned from performing and stripped of his freedom to write and publish. Last year, he spent 5 weeks in prison for publicly supporting the monks' demonstrations. The following is an extract from Zarganas' unpublished memoir of his first arrest in 1988. Your name, Zargano. No, the original one, Mong Thura. Do you have other names? No. Don't you have names that your friends and colleagues use? Oh, that, lots of them. Go on. Lanshagala, Kala Apoji, Uponaya, Zarseya, Mongyit, Kadenpon, Sean Connery, Big Daddy, Coco. That's enough, that's enough. Didn't I tell you there were lots? I'll just put down Kala Apogi. Up to you. That was the beginning of my interrogation in Military Intelligence Unit Number 6. It began about half an hour after I had been beaten in a small cell. My hands were cuffed behind me, and the hood over my head had not yet been removed. We consider you a gentleman and would like to examine you accordingly. You can help us by not concealing any information. Otherwise, there are ways to make you talk. Our team doesn't do that, but others will. We don't want that to happen to you, so... Three men, one in uniform with a camera, and two others entered the room. I thought it must be to record the interview, but I was wrong. Three photos were taken of me against a wall from either side, and then one from the front as I held up a placard that said, Thura or Zargana, Father Uung Than. Once the photo shoot was over, the interview began again, punctuated by blows that came at me from left and right, some mild and some hard. It went on until 6:30 in the evening. By then, the officers who were questioning me had been working for over 6 hours and were hungry, so they left the room and the proceedings came to a halt. Eventually, they returned for a third session. The night passed, and by 7 a.m., the interrogators appeared tired, so the questioning stopped. I was taken to a cell where they again handcuffed me and put a hood over my head. This room was not as grand as the one in which I had been beaten. It had about 9 square feet of flooring, was completely boarded up, and the air vents had been concealed with cardboard. It was filled with termite-eaten pieces of wood and rubbish. A dirty spittoon sat in one corner, and an incredibly thin mat lay on the floor. After quickly wiping away the dirt and debris, I dived onto the mat. The pain of the beating and the fact that I had been sitting all night had penetrated my flesh and my bones. Then they were there again, taking me back for further interrogation in the same costume, handcuffs and hood, questioning, answering, arguing, threatening and laughing. We went at it until 6 in the evening. Then I was returned to the cell where I had been held earlier. The next person I met was not an interrogator. He was the commanding officer, Major Sa Pa Went. For over 2 hours, he explained the Army's objectives to me. I had been promoted to the role of captive audience. By the time I returned to my cell after this listening exercise, exhaustion was slamming my eyes shut. But my eyes popped open again when Zen Wine, the famous Burmese actor, was brought into a neighboring cell. Weak from diarrhea and dehydration, he looked like a patient suffering from a terminal illness. After the guards left, I whispered to him. The man had been through an agonizing interrogation. Then a car arrived, and a major, smelling of alcohol, entered Zen Wine's cell. "Are you Zen Wine?" the major screamed over and over as he punched and kicked him. Zin was just saved when the soldiers who had accompanied the major intervened and pulled the officer away. It was then that I could see the wounds on Zin's shoulder and neck. If an ignorant, ordinary soldier had been responsible, it might have been forgivable. But an officer, it was ludicrous. And yet, there was nothing we could do except feel the anger in our hearts and gnaw at the iron bars in front of us. And lastly, a short poem by Zargana. It's called "However." We cry out, we've won, and raise both arms in joy. But when we lose, both arms rise again. Thanks.
I'll read a short text from Matida. The title is "Still Waiting." Despite Penn's best efforts, we don't know exactly how many writers and journalists have been jailed since 1988 uprising against military rule. This is not the text. This is a sort of introduction to it. But we do know that the number is in the hundreds and that several of our colleagues did not make it out of prison. The writer Cho Ji Ba Tao, a satirist, and Twin Za O died while serving sentences for their writings in 1991. Author Tin Shui died on June 8, 1997, in insane prison. Tan Ti, a columnist and journalist, Sao Win died in 1998. Min Thu died June 2004, and Wa Naiso, a poet, died the following month. There are no doubt more. There are currently many writers, journalists, and bloggers in prison in Burma in violation of their rights to freedom of expression. You are looking at photographs of many of them. Their names can be found on the back of tonight's program, along with information about how you can add your voice to the chorus of voices from around the world that are calling for their release. I'm going to read an excerpt from the short story, "Still Waiting," by Burmese writer, physician, and activist Ma Thida. In 1993, Thida was sentenced to 20 years in insane prison for her work to promote democratic change in Burma. She was accused of, quote, endangering the public peace, having contact with illegal organizations, and distributing unlawful literature. The subject of an international campaign led by PEN and Amnesty International, she was released on humanitarian grounds after serving 5 years, 6 months, and 6 days. Since her release in 1999, she has worked as an editor of a youth magazine and as a surgeon at the Muslim Free Hospital, which treats poor patients at no cost. She spent much of the last several months providing medical services to survivors of Cyclone Nargis. So this is reading from "Still Waiting." Frail living toys in filthy white prison uniforms crept one after another onto the train tracks in the open air. Za was indistinguishable among them. Each one carried a bulky bag on his back, a bedroll in one hand, a food carrier in the other, and a pair of iron chains on both feet. They all tried to wave, show thumbs up, say something, but they were carrying too much stuff and the guards herded them, warned them off. That was how Za looked in the open air. Seeing Za like this, worn out, bandy-legged, bent-headed, humped-backed, Yu was suddenly paralyzed, struck blind, deaf and dumb. Where are they sending you? This once bright, conscious voice woke up the whole platform. Other questions echoed. Everyone became anxious to get this information. Za and his friends didn't even know where they were going. They were walking senselessly, pausing for a while until the guards warned them again with a blast of whistle. Michena, a guard answered curtly. Michena is the capital of Kachin state, 250 miles from Mandalay. The road from Mandalay is terrible and the railway is also unreliable, sometimes taking 7 to 2 hours. Planes only fly twice a week and cost the skies for ordinary people. You measured the distance between her and Za. It might be about 30 feet, a little closer. If they would let her, she could help Za by carrying his bag and carrier. She could grasp Za's hands and hug him, no matter what the others thought. But for now, you just grip the plastic bag of food and drink for Za. Za, for his part, was confused whether he should stand back from the line, drop everything on the track, and open both his arms to greet you, who would certainly run to his chest in seconds, no matter what the guards would do him later. Hey, look, that's a lot of prisoners, probably drug addicts or murderers. Let's keep away from the platform. The thoughtless remark pierced Yu's eardrums. No, my husband is a medical doctor and a member of parliament. They are all political prisoners and they sacrificed their freedom and dignity for the benefit of all Burmese citizens, including you, she said in her head and heart. But she couldn't say those words out loud. You still stood there, paralyzed, blind and dumb. Suddenly, Za stopped. He had switched his hands to carry things more easily. He was concentrating on both you and the carrying. Za thought you seemed perplexed to see these embarrassing scenes. You finally realize what she should do. Here, I would like to give this food and drink for my husband, Sa. Oh, wait a minute. Yes, okay, I'll give your parcel to him. The guard quickly took the parcel from you. Who's your husband? Over there with the yellow bag on his back. Look, he's just stopped and looked at us now. See him? Oh, yes, I see. Please tell him I miss him and to take care. The guard left before you finished her sentence. Za thought he saw you asking the guard for something and pointing to him. So he stopped, pretending to fix the iron food chain to move easier. Here you are. That's from your wife. She misses you, she said. Please tell her our destination is Michena. She already knows. The warden left to arrange the seating plan on their new coach. Za saw the coach and realized he might soon lose his last chance to see you without barriers in the open air. He wanted to do something for you. He dropped everything he was carrying onto the track and started to wave both hands. The rest of his friends followed his example. Silence, shut up, just keep walking, pick your things back up. But they didn't care or even hear. You waved both hands too. Was this all she could do? She had hoped she might do something for Za apart from giving him food and drink. After all, here they were together, meeting in the open air. Maybe 30 feet away, Za picked up his things again and offered a faint goodbye smile to Yu. But his eyes shone strong and self-confident. Then he crawled up into the coach as if into a lair. Yu's eyes were glued to his back. She looked for a guard. Please help me and tell him I will come and see him at Michena prison soon. You won't be allowed to see him there until the end of this month, I think. But don't worry, he has enough food and other things. As you can see, their bags are bulky. Until end of this month, you repeated doubting. Yes, why not? It's standard for transferred prisoners to be kept without any outside contact for at least 2 weeks. You must wait a while, the guard explained as if this were perfectly normal. Of course, it had become normal to hear that word, waiting, since Za saw was arrested. 2008, Yu is still waiting in Mandalay. Za is still waiting in Michina. Every day, everyone is still waiting in prison and at home.
Last year, Burma and the world lost the person who was, in effect, Burma's poet laureate. We thought it would be appropriate to close the evening with a few of his poems. U Tin Mo was born in 1933, began writing poetry when he was 15. He attended the University of Mandalay at the urging of faculty members who had read and been impressed by his essays, and he soon became one of Burma's leading writers. U Tin Mo's poems became more political after he became involved in the pro-democracy movement in 1988, and he was arrested for his writing in 1991 and imprisoned for 4 years in Insein prison. Since then, all his published works have been banned in Burma. In April 1999, U Tin Mo went into exile and settled in the United States, where he continued to write his poems until his death on January the 22nd, 2007. I'm going to read 4 poems. The first 3 were translated by Mong Tha No, Sandra De Moor, and Christopher Merrill. Desert Years. Tears, a strand of gray hair, a decade gone. In those years, the honey wasn't sweet. Mushrooms wouldn't sprout, farmlands were parched. The mist hung low. The skies were gloomy, clouds of dust on the cart tracks, acacia and creepers and thorn spiral blossoms. But it never rained. And when it did rain, it never poured. In the village monastery, no bells rang, no music for the ear, no novice monks, no voices reading aloud, only the old servant with a shaved head sprawled among the posts. And the earth, like fruit too shy to emerge without fruit in shame and sorrow, glances at me. When will the tears change and the sweet bells ring? The second poem is called The Poet's Dreams. The treasures I own are only dreams. Although I have no diamonds, gold, or jewelry, no influence or power, I'm neither poor nor empty-handed. I have what you would call hope for the future, a boatload of dreams. My room is splendidly decorated with dreams, fragrant ones on display as in the marketplace. On dark nights, I hand out dreams of life, human dreams, with dazzling colors and patterns of diamonds and emeralds. My dreams. You can take them, only if you like them. Those who love the future will take them, I know. My only possessions, mere dreams, I give them away and make a wish. May you dream sweet dreams. The third poem is called Face. My love, who has taken my face for her refuge, who adores me. Every day, one aspect of it changes. At 20, I will look at the face of truth. I will not look at the face of the self. At 30, truth is no good. I will have to look at the face of work. This alone will do. At 40, I know the truth, but I can't look at it. I can't look it in the face. I know my work, but I can't look it in the face. I have to look at my wife's face, my children's faces. I dare not do what is true or right. If you don't do what is true, the enemy versus us thing gets confusing. You will fall and curl up quietly. At 50, 60, 70, don't let people despise you as you grow old. That's how the world is. The enemy versus us thing is a reference to Mao Zedong's dictum that revolutionaries must be clear about who is their enemy and who is their friend. The kind of enemy inside kind of illusion. U Tin Mo first recited this last poem at a memorable meeting the National League for Democracy held on December the 9th, 1988. The event was one of the annual lectures or mass literary rallies that traditionally celebrated Writers' Day in Burma. These gatherings were the only occasions where writers could communicate directly with their readers, free from censorship. The events were banned in September 1988, but the NLD defied that ban. This particular meeting was chaired by Win Tin, about whom Paulo Pinheiro spoke so movingly earlier in the evening and whose release we're able to celebrate today. And Tin Mo delivered the keynote lecture on poetry as a source of inspiration to the nation, which included this poem. "The Years We Didn't See the Dawn," it's called. "Half asleep, half awake, a time of dreaming dreams. I wanted to walk, but did not know which road to take. Half unknowing, my days are running out, my paunch thickens and my neck folds sag as I grow older. A time of getting nowhere. I have passed through all this time, unheeding, as in a train one passes stations by. As a young man, I met with Lenin, but growing older, I would like to meet Lincoln. The way we live now, submitting reports loaded with lies, recording 'yes, sir, certainly, sir,' onto tapes filled with misinformation, our smart party jackets now all creased and musty, we are treated like tea flasks, put here, sent there at our boss's bidding. Robots, our lives without joy, we merely nod our heads. At this time, we are not poetry. We are not human. This is not life. This is just so much waste paper. We have bartered away our lives for falsehood, and now we've reached old age. At death's very door, surely these times should be put on record as the years we didn't see the dawn." An extraordinary poem to read from the Lincoln Podium. So, in conclusion, on behalf of Penn and the Open Society Institute, the New York Review of Books, above all, on behalf of the International Burmese Monks Organization, I'd like to thank you all again for coming. Tonight's event has raised over $13,500, all of which will go to the monks to support their ongoing Nargis relief efforts. Just before we close the evening, our special guests asked if they could offer a blessing in thanks for your support. So please join me in welcoming them and showing our appreciation for their courageous work. Thank you.
What do you want?